Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today we welcome Amanda Fabiano. She is of Fabiano Consulting, which has now become Second Gate Advisory. Amanda, you are what has been named now the Mining Queen. Welcome to our show. It's nice to have you and it's nice to see you.
Thank you, Nick. It's so nice to see you. I haven't seen you since 2019 in Palm Springs at a very special event that we put on.
That's right. And yeah. It's been a long time, but I've been following your work ever since. And we're really excited to talk about mining in general. But the reason they call you the Mining Queen is because you were there at the beginning with Fidelity and mining. So can you tell us that story and give us a little bit of history into your background with Bitcoin mining?
Yeah, sure. So I started at Fidelity and I was there for about 7 years. I worked on first Bitcoin education. So I would bring in speakers. That's how I met a lot of people in the industry, put on programs to teach people within the walls of Fidelity about Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. And then we opened that up and we did a couple of events externally. So we did a layer two event and we did a mining event in 2019. And that was really helpful to kind of showcase some of the work that we were doing and our interest at Fidelity. Fidelity was really ahead of the curve on a lot of the things related to this industry. And the group that I worked in was called Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. What's really interesting was that group was created in 1999 when Abby's, I think it was her dad at the time, was wondering why Fidelity wasn't as prepared for the Y2K changeover than it should have been. So he said, hey, we need a group that's looking at trends and technologies of the future that might disrupt our businesses. And that's how Fidelity Center for Applied Technology came about. It was a really great place to learn about Bitcoin because it was almost a launch pad for a lot of us. There's me, there's Nick Carter, there's Alex Thorne, there's Matt Walsh, there's Katie Chase, right? There's a lot of, and more, a lot of different groups that started out of like this like Fidelity Center. And so it was really cool to be part of that and build that and also learn about the world through an institutional lens versus a traditional lens. I don't think a lot of people came from like this large company when they started thinking about mining. Things that were important that we had to learn about were things like disaster recovery plans, right? Risk profiles, risk mitigation, how to properly model things out in a way that would make sense that the senior leadership would agree to. So I think it was a fantastic place to start. We, you know, in about 2018, Fidelity was really early on in mining. So they were mining in 2013, super, super early, right? And it was a small, like, kind of like the size of it would be funny now too, when you think about like the size of these like large public miners. And they had a small farm and we were seeing about a 30% failure rate on the machines. And we said, hey, like, let's look into this. Let's like redo this. We haven't looked into mining in a while. And at that time, the majority of hash rate was in China. No one was really focused on it. And I just thought it was fascinating. I was like, you know, there's no Bitcoin without Bitcoin mining. Why is no one really talking about this or focusing on this? So I just dove in with my partner, Yuri, at the time, who's now the head of mining at Foundry Digital. And so, you know, really kind of thought about like different products and services that we could offer. And then, you know, left in 2020 to go to Galaxy and start a mining business there and was there for the last three years. And for the last year, I've been out on my own on doing advisory work. So it was really fun to start at Fidelity. I thought, you know, such an interesting place to start a journey in Bitcoin. So, you know, it's not like, you know, you talk to most people, they're like, I started a farm on my own, you know, in my backyard and, you know, got it going. But we kind of took the opposite approach where we started at a large company and then had to learn the smaller side of things.
The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by Unchained, the leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with collaborative multi-sig vaults where you hold two of three keys and benefit from a Bitcoin security partner. This is a really important feature. You can purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage with Unchained's trading desk and completely eliminate your exchange risks. Unchained also offers the best IRA product in the industry. You can convert easily your 401k or IRA into Bitcoin while keeping control of your keys. Don't pay more in taxes than you have to. Go talk to them today, unchained.com/TBL, and make sure you use code TBL for $99 off when you create an account. Billions of dollars in digital assets have already been stolen in 2024. The shocking part? Mobile carrier security is the cause. Stealing your phone number through a SIM swap attack has never been easier. Hackers can use your phone number to access your Bitcoin wallet, bank and email data, and even your social media accounts. The solution? Ifani. Unlike regular carriers, Ifani locks SIM transfers by default while still offering top-tier AT&T and Verizon service. Switch your phone service to Ifani today and protect your assets. Go to ifani.com/TBL and use code TBL to save $99. Imagine losing your Bitcoin fortune to a house fire or to accidental damage. A complete nightmare, right? It's estimated that over 30% of Bitcoin are lost forever, and poor seed phrase security is a big reason why. That is why we use Stampseed, a really cool DIY kit that allows you to stamp your seed into these titanium plates. So let me show you how it works. They send you a titanium plate. Part of the kit comes with this really easy to use tracker. You slide your seed phrase into the tracker. Now you take the letters that they send you, you take a letter out, and you place it into your device, and then you take this incredibly heavy duty titanium hammer, and you hammer your letters into this titanium plate. Your full seed phrase will be stamped into this titanium plate that is fireproof, accident proof, damage proof. These tools have been specifically designed by people working in titanium stamping for over 14 years. So go check them out today, stampseed.com, and make sure you use code TBL for 15% off of your order. And I want the audience to understand that the fidelity aspect to Bitcoin and Bitcoin history, it plays into my general, or it played into my overall thesis into Bitcoin back in 2016 when I started studying this field. So I observed two things. I observed Fidelity mining Bitcoin for the last few years at that time, and I observed MIT starting to study and collaborate with Fidelity.
Yeah.
And with both of these institutions getting involved in Bitcoin, it was one of those moments that made me, as an, you know, an intellectual person, someone who is curious, it's told me it's time to study this thing. And that's when I went full study into Bitcoin, and then I could never unsee it. But up until that point, it was just, I heard the word Bitcoin, but never decided to try. Fidelity and MIT were crucial in that time. So the signal that we get, and we've had Alex Thorne as a regular here at the program, we've talked about Fidelity. Nick Carter, people might not know, Nick Carter helped me with the last couple chapters of Layered Money.
Yeah.
When I was writing it, because I wanted to consult somebody who really understood digital currency as a whole. So this whole original Fidelity Mafia, as Alex calls them, you guys are crucial in the early history of Bitcoin. So with that out of the way, why was Fidelity mining in 2013? What was the impetus there? And do you think that that was maybe the beginning of bringing Bitcoin mining to global industrial rather than just a China output?
Yeah, so Fidelity was always curious. So Abby Johnson, the CEO, is a real advocate for Bitcoin. She spoke at Consensus in 2016 or 2017. And so she was really interested in like all of the aspects of Bitcoin. And so when the incubator that I worked in, the role was to build products and features for Fidelity for the long term. Fidelity Digital Assets came out of that incubator, right? And that's like the large custody group that they have now. And so all ideas were considered good, right? Which was really a cool way. And also your ideas were put on trial. It was, is this a good idea? And people would poke at them, right? And you were able to like think about things critically. So a different diverse group of backgrounds too. You have traditional finance, you have Bitcoin people, you have newer people to their career, you have older people in their career, and you were able to learn about why someone would like something or wouldn't like a product. So it was a really cool way to do it. I think the fact that they're mining and they're continuing to mine is fantastic, but I think that the mining industry, I don't think that Fidelity gave it like the grounds that it has now. I think it helped because it helped legitimize that this is real, and Fidelity as a whole helped legitimize that Bitcoin was real, and they were one of the first. But I think that Bitcoin on its own took off its own trajectory. I don't think we could ever say that one company, regardless of how big it is the reason why, you know, Bitcoin, people started mining Bitcoin. But I think it helps in the overall storyline. So when we saw the China ban happen, what we saw is miners start to look at locations that were a little bit more beneficial to them from a geopolitical risk perspective. And the U.S. has really good, well, for the most part, good locations that you can mine Bitcoin at. We've obviously faced some adversity, and that has created some, you know, political changes and shifts and narratives, and why people are focusing on educating politicians, right, versus just saying, you know, Bitcoin will fix this. But I think that overall, when China shut down, everyone started looking at places that worked, and we saw them look at places that like might have worked, but then it didn't. So, for example, like Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan was a place that a lot of miners went to because there was cheap electricity, and then there was all these taxes and rules that were put into place, and it became a place that wasn't that effective to mine Bitcoin because you had to deal with all of this other stuff. The alternative was Texas, which has its own grid, ERCOT, right, which like has a lot of great capabilities for a miner to do very good in. We've seen Riot do an incredible job with hedging their power and making money off of the power side of things. So I think generally miners will go to places that are the best for their bottom line with good, you know, geopolitical risks like on top of it.
And I want to ask you about this failure rate, 30%. Why were the miners failing in the early days, and what did you guys learn from it? Because you point out something important about Fidelity not having some sort of outsized impact on the trajectory of the industry as a whole, and that's important. But you guys were probably not mining to mine and become a mining giant. You were mining to learn. So what did you learn when you guys were seeing that type of fail rate?
We learned that, and this is still the case, right? The machines are, they're not truly commoditized yet, right? So every few years or every couple of years, new machines come on the market that have better efficiency than the last generation of machines. And so in order to have the best fleet, like you have to upgrade your machines. And so at that point, we were seeing like, okay, 30% failure rate, what are we going to do? And exactly what every other miner does now, we upgraded our machines. And then we had to look at, where do we plug them into? Do we plug them in locally at one of our tier one data centers, or do we plug them in at a mining facility? And so this whole like AI narrative that is existing today, where people are like, oh yeah, like mining facilities can be AI infrastructure, it's kind of hilarious to me, because my first like thought that I had to prove at Fidelity was like, it doesn't make sense to mine Bitcoin in a tier one data center because you require redundancy power and the cost is higher and you don't need fiber internet, right? So like it's one of those things where like now we're seeing that kind of level up here, and I'm like, oh man, this is like the first thing that we had to prove didn't work. And so it's interesting that we were able to see some of those things kind of happen before they actually became like mainstream narratives, right? But yeah, the failure rate on the machines is just because the machines don't last forever. And so as new gen machines come out, you want to upgrade your machines. And so that's ultimately like what we did and what we see miners do now. You see miners announce crazy, like large orders, right? And then you see their stock price go up because everyone knows their efficiency is going to go up and they'll mine more Bitcoin, hopefully.
We want to learn more about what you are doing now that you're out on your own with your own consultancy and advisory. So I want to get into what type of clients you're dealing with. But let's first talk about an article recently where you were crowned this, the shadow mining queen of Bitcoin, when I read the article, I kind of nodded in agreement because I know the industry and I know from your days at Fidelity to the days at Galaxy that people just regard you as one of the foremost experts in mining in the world. So the title made sense to me, but one of the interesting parts of the article was that it gave you credit for orange pilling Donald Trump. So can you tell us the story there? How did you get involved? When did David Bailey get involved, and how did that whole thing evolve?
Yeah, I think I'm like a very small, like small, tiny piece in the overall storyline. For the shadow queen of mining, I don't understand it, but like, you know, here we are. And so I think like it's very nice that people say that, but it's like, I'm just literally a nerd about Bitcoin mining, and I just like to build cool things. And that's like ultimately what I enjoy. And so with my new advisory company, I really get to work on things that I think are interesting and that, you know, I want to spend time on. I think that time is our most valuable asset. And if you can use your time to things that you find are great, you're doing good things for yourself and for the world. So that's how I look at it. David is actually my neighbor. And so we were at dinner one night and he said he had been talking to the campaign and he had said, you know, we want to do a mining roundtable. Will you help me try to organize it? And I was like, yeah, of course, because I do think that miners have faced a lot of adversity in being able to build. At the end of the day, miners are builders, right? They want to build a company. They want to build their facilities. The politics is not really something that I think any of us really care too much about, but you have to. Bitcoin should be apolitical, but unfortunately, it has become very political over the past year. And, you know, if we have the opportunity to try to teach someone about Bitcoin and the benefits of Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining, and it could be a top-down approach, we absolutely should be leaning in and trying to do that. I thought the mining roundtable in Mar-a-Lago went really well. I think that it was great to bring some executives in and be able to share the stories and share that Bitcoin is good for the grid, right? Bitcoin is made by people in rural communities, right? Like that, like local piece always gets lost in the mainstream narrative. And it's usually like, oh, the noise is too loud, but it's like usually not the workers that have full-time jobs that are saying those things. It's like some random neighbor that's upset about something else, right? So I think, you know, there's these like narratives that I have always thought were really good for Bitcoin and mining and why I spend my time on it. And it was really cool to be able to present that to someone with such like a platform that could potentially, if things go a certain way, help us versus hurt us in the future. So miners, you know, every 2 years in Texas, new bills come in and it's like, you know, trying to ruin certain situations for Bitcoin miners. And there's usually a lack of education there. And so miners have had a lot of like bottom up approach to education, but this was like a top down approach that I was like, I absolutely will raise my hand and try to help on it. I think that there was a lot of people involved in it. The article was very sweet, but there's a lot of behind the scenes work that happens. And there's a lot of really great people at Bitcoin Inc. that did a ton of work to make this happen and get Trump to Nashville. So, you know, the stories are always, there's the story that you hear and then there's the story behind the scenes. And so, you know, the behind the scenes story of, you know, all the different people that it required to make it's successful for Trump to get to Nashville was much bigger than, you know, what like 500 words on an article can say. So like super, super small part, like I wouldn't give myself any credit for it.
Well, Amanda, you're very modest, but we know that over time, education is what leads and people look for that leadership when it comes to the ultimate voice and getting into the pro Bitcoin camp, because I think you and I are in agreement that pro-Bitcoin is just about pro-enterprise and freedom of enterprise that might be technological in nature or not. Yep. It almost doesn't matter what nature the enterprise is. As long as it's not harming others, it is our right to engage in those types of enterprises. So that's why Bitcoin is apolitical. It shouldn't be political to be right. pro-enterprise, but unfortunately, it can be.
Well, I think what has happened over the past 4 years has made it a bit political. And I wish that wasn't the case, right? Like I have actually never said my political stance on any of this, right? I've just been here to educate someone that was willing to have a conversation on it. But I think that because of how we've been treated as an industry over the past 4 years, it has been, very unfortunate to see how things have played out. And so when you have the opposite side saying, like, I'll raise my hands and like take a like learn about this, there is no reason why we shouldn't try to do that. I think that that is net positive for everybody. And it did help push the other side to then say, hey, hold on a second. Are these people real? Maybe we should have a conversation about it.
Absolutely. And we agree. And that's what we've been emphasizing here as well at the Bitcoin layer, is that the treatment of the industry has made it political. Mm-hmm. And so we agree with you there. I want to ask you about your advisory now. So what type of clients are you working with? You mentioned that the new your new advisory is fun because you get to work on things that you're interested in. So what are those things? And I'm curious what someone who's kind of seen it all in the mining industry is consulting on now.
So I really like building businesses. I think that that's what I found when I was at Galaxy, was like building that 0 to 3 year business where you were able to build a strategy and execute on it and build a team was so cool, right? And so I wanted to try to take those skill sets and help other groups do that. So having the institutional background, having the Galaxy background, I thought, you know what, let me try to see if I can go out and help others. We have, you know, a decent amount of clients, and we do different things with each client. So we have one group that is a public miner, for example, that is we're working on M&A with them. We have another group that we are working on, you know, day-to-day operational processes with them. We have a group that we work on thinking about how to de-risk the payment mechanism between hosting and hosting clients. So, you know, right now, miners, you prepay for a month for electricity to your hosting provider, but, you know, you don't always use that. There's, you know, there's other like deposits and fees that exist, right? How do you kind of reduce that friction so that each person has the money when they need it? So there's like some really cool work on that that's being done. We do a variety of different things. And I think what we really do is we try to find people that are trying to build really cool products or really cool businesses. And that's who we want to work with. It's really hard because not every single day is the same day. And that's what's really fun for me. I find that like I can get creative with the group and help them build something that is, you know, unique and interesting and also useful to the industry as a whole. And it also allows me to work with a bunch of different people, which is fun, right? There's a lot of really intelligent people in the mining industry. And so being able to have some, accessibility to them and learn from them and teach them things has been, I think, one of the most rewarding parts of my career.
And so what is the future right now of mining? What are you advising clients on, whether it comes to the location? Because I'm really interested in the geopolitical side, which countries are the most advantageous, and which has to do with both the geopolitics and the political side and the regulation side, but also the cost of electricity and the access to that electricity. Both of those play the types of technology, the type of cooling. What are you, I'm really curious about what you're,
what's
the direction?
On the upside of things, we tend to like group miners together and assume that they all have the same like processes and like they all have the same strategies, but miners have very different strategies from like location, power, treasury management, right? Like overall management. So I think usually like each miner, you have to decide like, what are they trying to accomplish? It's like, of course, we're all trying to mine the most Bitcoin that you possibly can, but it's like, what are the constraints that they have from like a dollar perspective, from a location perspective, from, you know, overall, like what they're capable of doing perspective, right? Like all of those things matter. And then what is the end goal of like a specific location? We're seeing a lot more groups have sites for sale, like greenfield sites for sale, brownfield sites for sale. And they're like, we want a crazy amount of money, right? Because like we have these like access to power that everyone wants. I think what we're seeing more broadly is compute become a topic of discussion, right? So it's not just about Bitcoin mining anymore. It's about access to energy for general compute, which is kind of interesting, right? Miners obviously are a huge driver of that, but we're seeing miners diversify a bit too. When I look at like, there's no like blanket thing that I could say to you that I'd be like, miners should only be mining in Texas. And that's great, right? Like, cause that's not really what I think. I think that every situation requires a different set of risk perimeters and, you know, risk analysis, and then you decide whether or not that works for a specific company within the realm of like what they're trying to do. So ops, ops can be relatively boring in a way, but like strategy of the ops gets really exciting.
Now, I want to ask you also about when it comes to these Bitcoin miners, we know that there are giants.
Yeah.
Right? And these giants have 1-3% of the hash rate of the whole network. And that's astounding to think about, but it's the nature of the business now. So are there mom and pops, or are there like VC funded, angel funded mining operations that are popping up around the world? Are there countries that you can name where these things are happening? What's going on at the grassroots? Like I think I can do it cheaper, you know, and better than, you know, the giants because I'm nimble. What's going on there?
Yeah, I think the barrier to entry gets harder as some of these larger miners continue to grow and expand. But really what it comes down to is access to capital and also the cost of the capital that you have. So we saw over 2020, 2021, a lot of miners go public. They went public because of access to capital. Mining is not a VC investment, right? It's not really like a return on capital investment, especially when you're looking at other things that are being built in the overall crypto industry, right? You can either get a token or you could invest in this miner where they're going to have to renew their machine every 3 years and hope that their energy strategy works out right. Like, it doesn't really fit into a VC traditional bucket. So you saw miners try to think about where do we get access to capital, and that is on the public markets. And so we saw that happen. Right now we see about 30% of the total overall network is public miners. So that means 70% is still not public miners, right? So where those are, we don't know. We love that, right? Decentralization is great. What the 70% has a hard time with is that access to capital. So how do they continue to grow and expand, like the public guys who have, you know, ATMs, the ability to get converts, right? A different set of capital providers. So I think like getting into it now, if you need large sums of money, or, you know, revamping your facility, if you need large sums of money on the private side, is extremely difficult still. So we're not seeing a ton of like, coverage on the private side, because there's not a lot of like capital providers going to the private side. They're more like aiming for the public because of that liquidity. And so it makes it difficult to get going on the mining side if you are smaller and public.
Yeah, it's very interesting to learn that and to hear you explain it like that, because it does make sense that these miners now have such access to capital, in which it really makes it difficult, you know, and that barrier to entry. And I imagine that the role of the debt and equity financing balance, so the corporate finance role within the large Bitcoin miner, becomes absolutely paramount. And, you know, the timing of your interest payments, your hedging, your re-up on the machines, all of that becomes just so crucial and, you know, important to stay alive. So did we learn anything from some of the bankruptcies over the last couple of years? What did you learn?
Yeah, the bankruptcies were quite interesting. I was going to say, I think we learned that like over-leveraging on debt when you don't have a power hedge or a power strategy in place is probably not the right move. I think, you know, growth at all sake for growth is not also a really great move. Unfortunately, what we saw was miners were being judged on future capacity from the public side of things. So it kind of fueled this, like, keep growing. How do you keep growing? You grow by debt, take on this debt, right? And then when we had the perfect storm in 2021 with energy prices skyrocketing, Bitcoin prices decreasing, and then capital markets closing, it really hard for miners. What I see on the positive side is miners are extremely resilient. A lot of them bounce back, right? And they were able to do it at an even better rate before. So this is still a really new industry. And I think we're kind of all learning as we're going. We're able to draw from different, you know, people's experiences, and, you know, being on the other side of this with like the bankruptcies make life a lot easier to be like, oh, well, you should never do that again, right? Because like we saw that happen over here. So we have some more case studies. The one thing that I would say that is the most asked question for me for new people coming to me on advisory is to help them raise capital. So I'm not really interested in doing that. I'm more interested in like building products, right? But on the private side, that is the number one asked question. So there are still a lot of people that are trying to build, but the like access is just hard. And so you know, we'll see how that kind of plays out over the course of the next like 3 to 4 years with this like epoch. Like, will very miners still be at, will public miners still be at 30% of the network, or will they be more?
Absolutely. Well, it's something that fascinates us. We've interviewed pretty much every CEO of the publicly traded miners. And you mentioned compute. We've talked with Iron, and we, to be very honest, it's hard to understand from the outside perspective what the exact strategy is on the trade-off. You know, between when they switch one machine off and when they switch the other machine on, or which one gets the electricity, or which one gets the next order, because you get new cash. So you have to buy new machines. Do you buy new Bitcoin miners, or do you buy
when do you make that decision, NVIDIA? Right? Like what? Yeah. So I, from how I understand it and from building things, up until the medium voltage, everything is the same, right? So you can buy a 20 megawatt site, you can build most things out to it until you get to the actual data center. And then that's where it becomes like, do you have power? Do you have redundancy? Do you have redundancy power? You obviously have power, you have a data center. Do you have the right type of fiber connectivity? Do you have air conditioning, right? Do you have excess power? Because when you mine, like when you say 20 megawatts, not all 20 megawatts goes towards mining Bitcoin, right? There's parasitic load. There's, you know, things that you need to run like fans, PSUs, right? With AI, you need a lot more extra energy than you do on the other side. So what I don't understand is when people say they can retrofit any site, because the cost to build out an AI site is so much higher than the cost to build out a mining site. So I'm still skeptical on like the reverse thing, but I am not skeptical on the ability for that, for any group to build out in the future for capacity that's coming down the line. The question I have is like, when do you decide? Because a lot of these items have like a longer lead time than you think. So a transformer, for example, takes about like, and that is the same to, regardless of what the end use is, it takes about 18 months sometimes to get a transformer. So it requires like a lot of these like really long thought processes and timeframes. So at some point, those questions have to come up of like, okay, what are we using this for? And what's the best use case? And then do we have the capital to build out the AI side of things? Because it's so much higher than the mining side.
Amanda, what is the most exciting thing for you right now in the industry? Mm-hmm. What are you looking forward to? What are you working on that is really, yeah, what's capturing your imagination right now? As somebody that's been around in Bitcoin for a long time, you know, it, I think it's interesting to know what is most interesting to you right now.
Yeah, so I think the way that miners manage their treasury over the next like 12 months should be really interesting. And also how they manage their SG&A costs will be really interesting. For treasury, we just saw Luxor come out with the ability to hedge out your hash rate for 12 months in the future, which has never really happened before, right? Like that's like a new version of that product. I don't work officially with Luxor, but I think that what they're doing on the hash rate derivative side of things is really cool. And I think once we see more sophisticated traditional banks and traders come into the space, which we already have a lot of sophisticated traders, but when you see some of the trading firms come in and they think about like, how do you provide services to miners that are useful, there really aren't that many right now. So I really think what would be interesting is having different products on the finance side for miners. And this has been like a chicken and egg problem for a while. Right now what is offered is like Bitcoin backed loans. It's like, those aren't really that great, right? Like everyone has had those. Like, why would you give like all of your Bitcoin to a group that to make like 2% yield on it? Like, that's not that cool when you can make 2% yield on your operation by just like tweaking some things on the efficiency side of things, right? So I think what I really am looking forward to is like a new gen of financial products that are built on top of the Bitcoin mining layer and stack that then make mining, I think, like boring. and make like those financial products more exciting.
Yeah, when you mentioned that, I think about options, and options can represent a powerful hedging tool for a miner, for any commodity producer. And the build out of a lot of financial markets and options markets actually comes from the need to hedge corn and wheat prices forward from farmers back in the 19th century. So these things are very important to develop, and we will continue to watch that with you. Amanda Fabiano, thank you so much for joining us today at the Bitcoin Layer. Yeah, please tell people where they can find your work.
I'm @_Amanda_Fab on Twitter.
Excellent. Amanda, we'll look forward to following your work, and we'll see you guys next time.
Thank you.